Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, December 15th, 2019. I'm John Manning, and I'll be with you for the next hour. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. Work begins at future site of Clear Lake Lumber Yard. Spare change helps local schools. Regional outlook today, cold today with clouds and sun. Expect 2 to 4 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 75% and poor drying conditions. Considerable cloudiness tonight. Average relative humidity 75%. Mostly cloudy tomorrow. Expect less than 2 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 80%. Work begins at future site of Clear Lake Lumberyard by Ashley Stewart. Work is underway at the future site of Woodford Lumber and Home Company in Clear Lake. The lumberyard, which celebrated its 150th anniversary earlier this year, will be relocating from downtown to 1800 7th Avenue North next spring. "We're excited," said Jan Leville, Woodford Lumber president. "We really are." The fifth-generation family-owned business is a full-service lumberyard and retail center and Benjamin Moore paint store. In June, Woodford Lumber purchased the former Superior Lumber building after the Charles City-based lumberyard closed. The property, including 3.16 acres and nearly 26,000 square feet in commercial buildings visible from U.S. Highway 18, will be beneficial for the customer because of its accessibility and its larger retail space, Lovell said after the purchase. "We're expanding our showroom big time. We'll actually have triple the space by adding on out there at the new location," she said. "Our goal is really to be a great asset for the community and for North Iowa." Lovell said the additional showroom space will allow Woodford Lumber to display more products and provide a much more exciting and creative space for professional builders and do-it-yourselfers. The showroom will feature complete kitchen and bathroom layouts, an expanded paint display, and more. Woodford Lumber will also partner with Do It Best Corp, which will allow customers to order products online with in-store pickup at its new location. Individuals with Burka Construction, Larkin Construction, Complete Concrete, Yon Company, Jim Hunt Electric, Lake Plumbing, and Alliant Energy are working to prepare the building for its spring opening. "It's kind of a beehive of activity," Lovell said. Woodford Lumber was started in 1869 at its current location, 210 North 4th Street, by Lovell's great-great-grandfather's brother, Truman Woodford. The lumberyard is now managed by Lovell and her husband, Tom, Darrell Hoshaw, manager, and Michelle Collins, assistant manager. The business employs at least 8 full-time and part-time employees with more than 250 years of combined lumberyard experience. Woodford Lumber hopes to relocate all of its services to the new location in the spring, Lovell said, adding, "The fate of the current location remains to be decided. We're looking at a lot of different options," she said. "We would want it to be a good thing for the community for sure." Spare Change Helps Local Schools by Grace Saplatsky. Everyone has that jar in the house where they put their spare change to save up for something. Winnebago Industries' spare change jar was used to help area elementary schools. Belmont Clemmie, Forest City, and North Iowa Elementary Schools each received a $400 gift card from Winnebago Industries' sawmill division mid-November. Winnebago Industries Manufacturing Supervisor Keith Albertson said the sawmill employees were looking for an act of giving they could do as a group and came up with the idea of each employee contributing all of their spare change to the fundraiser jar for the fourth quarter of the fiscal year. They were all excited doing it, digging in the bottom of their purse or in their car, throwing their change into the jar at work, and it really added up quick, Albertson said. After about 12 weeks, at the end of the quarter in August, the 44 employees had gathered $1,200, including some funds matched by some people, well over their goal of $300. "It got kind of funny at times. Some people would come in and go, 'Who hasn't put their money in the jar this week?'" Albertson said. With the unexpected amount of money, Albertson said each employee wrote their hometown's elementary school on a piece of paper, put it into a hat, and he picked three schools to receive $400 each. We wanted to make sure it was enough that it could really make an impact, he said. We just didn't want to give everybody $100 or $200. We wanted to give them a little bit more. Albertson said he wanted to do something as a group with the other employees. It wasn't mandatory, but everybody participated, he said. Everybody did. They chose to give the money to the younger children because there are some families who have hardships, and the money will be dispersed by the school as it sees fit, Albertson said. Belmont Clemmy Superintendent Dan Frazier said the money will be placed in the school's nurses fund to buy winter clothing, socks, hats, and other items the students need. Albertson said Winnebago Industries is always doing some sort of fundraiser or drive to do something for the community. Winnebago Industries public relations specialist Saul Jeffson said the company has set a goal for every employee to participate in a, quote, project related to giving, quality, or safety, unquote, every year. We've seen a lot of people helping out with different projects that are community related or giving in nature, which is really rewarding to see, he said. Last week, the sawmill employees did the polar bear plunge with grass skirts and coconut bras theme, raising $1,055 for Toys for Tots and Make-A-Wish Foundation, according to Albertson. They've also done other projects, such as cleaning yards and ditches and painting garages, as well as food drives. We're not only trying to collect money, Albertson said. Other Winnebago Industries departments are actively doing similar work, with coats and clothing drives in the visitor center and the engineering department cleaning up part of Pilot Knob State Park. Just wherever we see that there might be a need or where employees help out, there's been some nice movement toward that kind of volunteering and giving, Jeffson said. Moss unveils new artwork in Osage by Deb Nicolay, special to the Press News. Pat Moss, known as P. Buckley Moss to the art world, came to Osage last week to unveil a new work that proved dear to citizens of this small Mitchell County town, a rendering of the historical Cedar Valley Seminary building. She came on the invitation of Alan Young, owner of the local framing shop, Frames and More. As a new dealer in her works, Young commissioned the artwork and provided time for customers to meet Moss, who, despite the wily and wet Iowa weather, kept smiling and chatting with those who wanted to add to their Moss collection or to discover her artistry for the first time. An early junior college, the seminary was among the first educational institutions of its kind in Iowa. Osage's famous son, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Hamlin Garland, attended classes there. Over her two-day stay, Moss, 86, was more than happy to learn about the area and the seminary. She chatted about her life, her art, and her passion for providing art education to children who might not otherwise have the opportunity. The P. Buckley Moss Foundation for Children's Education provides support for art projects and curricula that help kids with learning disabilities. Moss said she knew how it felt to be the non-achieving student in most subjects. As a child growing up in New York City, she had a hard time with school due to dyslexia, but she found she excelled in art. I didn't know why it was that way, she said, but I also knew I could do some things better than the other kids could. That confidence took her all the way to a successful art career and a life she clearly loves. A watercolorist, she creates paintings that capture many of the rural areas in her beloved Shenandoah Valley in and around Radford, Virginia, where she lives most of the year. Many show the Amish and Mennonite culture, whose simple lifestyles captured her interest early. But she also loves landscapes and wildlife. Many of her works show birds, especially geese. A preservationist at heart, she also loves older buildings and capturing them in her art. Most evoke a simple serenity. Moss still smiles wide when recalling her first successful showing some 50 years ago. It was in Roanoke, Virginia, and I ended up selling just about everything, she said. I can remember being so excited. It was a thrill. Finally, I could buy the paper, the brushes I needed. Her art has brought her international renown and legions of fans. Her daughter, Patty Moss, traveled with her to Osage and is the chief operating officer of the P. Buckley Moss Galleries. Some of Patty's other siblings are also involved in the family business. Patty Moss confided that her mother continues to paint all the time. And on nights before appearances, Moss rarely sleeps at all. I think it's just thinking about going, making sure everything is ready, Patty said. Moss has traveled the world and has lived in Panama. Oh yes, I had chickens walking through my kitchen, she said with a little chuckle. And Italy. She still owns a home in Cortona in the Tuscany region of Italy. Italy is a special place in her family since her mother was from Sicily. Another daughter co-owns the home with her there. When there, we get up in the morning and go to Florence and find a place to sketch or paint, she said. It's a wonderful place, very beautiful. It comes as no surprise that her favorite painters are Modigliani, El Greco, and Picasso, particularly energetic and passionate painters. Her love of painting is continually sparked by new ideas and techniques. As artists, we are always trying new things, she said, adding that she has a love of creating etchings. When asked how long it typically took her to paint a subject, she gave her now famous and often quoted answer. I say it took me 86 years, she said with a grin, because really that's the truth. Her years of experience and practice are always part of her next work. She seems content with those years, over which she has painted hundreds of pieces. Moss continues to enjoy meeting new people, speaking about those things that inspire her works and her life. Those relationships, she says, are important. You get involved wherever you are. You want to be involved. You make connections, she said, smiling. Barb Reuter's Lifetime of Loving Paper Dolls by Jessua Christians. Since the age of four, a love of paper dolls has carried Barb Reuter of Forest City through a lifetime of enjoying the paper creations. First ones I ever played with were the Lennon Sisters, Reuter said. They were a singing group on the Lawrence Welk show. I was really young. I remember the yellow suit on the girl because yellow was my favorite color. Reuter said the paper dolls belonged to her neighbor, who had allowed her and her sister to play with them. We would dress them in their pretty dresses, and I thought they were so much fun, and I thought, I've got to get some as soon as I can, Reuter said. That simple, delightful thought started her paper doll journey, has taken her from simply admiring her friend's paper dolls to attaining her own, even building on those interests into her adult life. Reuter is active with presentations in which she speaks of her collection of paper dolls, and her love for them, to nursing homes, churches, and other service organizations. I have six tubs I carry to presentations, Reuter said. I love making people laugh and sharing my stories. One story in particular Reuter finds very meaningful is that time she thought she had lost some of her favorite paper dolls. I used to play with Kate and Jenny, Reuter said. They were called School Pals, and on the cover they had taken... And on the cover they had the olden days telephone. I would pretend that they talked on the phone a lot. I played a lot with them, and they had these cute yellow dresses. I loved playing with these and could play with them for hours and hours. One day when Reuter came home from school, she couldn't find the paper doll anywhere. Reuter said she looked all over the house, turned over furniture, looked under it, looked in the attic, and even in the basement. I looked everywhere, Reuter said. I could not find the doll, so I was getting hysterical. So I was kind of sad and in grief over my paper dolls being lost. It was close to Christmas, but Reuter said she just wasn't in the Christmas spirit because she didn't have her favorite paper doll, Jenny. That really meant a lot to me, she said. Christmas morning, I sat down in the living room. My baby sister brought me this package and said, Barbie, I wanted to give you a present that you would love. Inside was Jenny. Her sister had taken her to give her to Reuter for Christmas. Reuter said, with a laugh, I thought it was wonderful and horrible all at the same time. I wondered, why would you steal my paper doll? But I was happy to get it back. Reuter's collection of paper dolls, reprints, and originals are from purchases from antique stores or online. Over the years, Reuter has accumulated too numerous amounts to count. Her interest has expanded to include her own creations of some full-bodied type paper dolls and a quilt with a paper doll theme. Reuter has also added royalty paper dolls purchased at a convention. They include Meghan and Harry and Kate and Meghan, autographed by the artist at the convention. Years ago, I worked as a reporter for the Globe Gazette, Reuter said. I had interviewed this lady who made a paper doll quilt. I thought about that many times since I did that story, and so here it is. after her first articles were published in the Paper Doll Review magazine in 2010. Another article had been published locally about her accomplishments. A lady from Garner had read the article in the Globe Gazette and invited her to do a mother and daughter tea presentation. Since that time, Reuter has been kept busy with her paper doll presentations throughout neighboring communities. Taliesin architect Floyd Hamblin to present on Frank Lloyd Wright by Globe Gazette staff. The River City Society for Historical Preservation has invited architect Floyd Hamblin from Taliesin to present a program on continuing Frank Lloyd Wright's Principles of Organic Architecture at 7 p.m. Wednesday at the Robert E. McCoy Architectural Interpretive Center, 520 First Street Southeast in Mason City. This program is open and free to the public. Seating is limited and is on a first-come, first-served basis. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Floyd Hamblin's connection to the Taliesin Fellowship started in 1985 when he worked extensively in the Frank Lloyd Wright Archive at Taliesin West, cataloging, photographing, and encapsulating Wright's original drawings and also parts of his extensive art collection. In 1987, Hamblin enrolled at the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture and earned his Master's of Architecture. In 1999, he was invited to join Taliesin Architects, practicing Wright's philosophy of organic architecture. Hamblin is currently a senior member of the Taliesin Fellowship and a faculty member of the School of Architecture at Taliesin. He runs his own architecture practice, Floyd Hamblin Architects, LLC, and makes his home at Taliesin in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Area nonprofits received over $28,000 from Alliant Energy Foundation. North Iowa nonprofit organizations were 3 of 15 statewide awarded community grants totaling $28,700 from the Alliant Energy Foundation. "We're looking for creative solutions that support our customers and communities," said Julie Bauer, executive director of the Alliant Energy Foundation, in a release. "Our nonprofit partners are constantly working to make life better. Community grants are one way we stand behind them as they solve problems for families, education, and the environment." These grants are among 144 the Alliant Energy Foundation awarded this grant cycle, totaling over $343,000, the release said. North Iowa nonprofits receiving grants. Clear Lake Community School District received $2,500 for its agriculture science program. Caring Pregnancy Center of Mason City received $1,500 for its parenting incentive program. North Iowa Vocation Center Incorporated in Mason City received $1,500 for its Community Connections program. In the Globe Gazette's opinion page today, Alan Gubert's editorial is entitled, "Welcome to the Climate Fight, Farmers. Now get in line." After 38 years in journalism, some events still cause shock. Many center on public officials holding private meetings where a Just Us Insiders intimacy affords all a better understanding, read total control, of their policy initiatives. Sorry, not sorry. But public policy doesn't work that way. There's no room for secrecy when public officials spend public money to promote legislation affecting the public. Still, public officials, and too often journalists, continue to violate that basic rule. The reason for the secrecy was, in a word, change. The time had come for the U.S. agriculture's A-list farm and food leaders, including three secretaries of agriculture, to agree that climate change was real and government action was needed to slow its rising impact on agriculture. But they couldn't be seen doing it in the open, reported Politico's Helena Botmiller-Evick. The veil of secrecy attested to just how sensitive the topic was to those largely conservative farmers and ranchers and lobbying behemoths, who had engaged in an open, bare-knuckled brawl against climate change's very existence for decades. The fact-laden story can be read now as both a hopeful, hey, we're in the game now piece on how the nation's biggest farm groups appear ready to tackle climate change, and as a lengthy, hey, where have you been, history of Big Ag's foot dragging and denial. The foot dragging angle is far more believable because it happened. The hopeful angle is far less believable because no featured person or group in the Politico piece offers one tangible policy idea to tackle climate change to advance at either the local, state, or national level. In fact, the biggest of the Big Ag masters at the invitation-only meeting, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue, couldn't even say the words climate change. According to Evich, Perdue, quote, did not refer to climate change or talk about paying farmers for carbon sequestration or offer a list of things his department would do to help. Others quoted were equally obtuse in what they were there to do. One noted that it takes a lot of leadership and a little bit of culture change to talk about it, it being climate change. Given Perdue's empty rhetoric, the well-meaning farmer would have been more accurate had he said it takes a lot of culture change and a little bit of leadership to talk about it. What's even more troubling than the meeting secrecy, however, is its selective guest list. How is it that about 100 U.S. farm and food leaders and politicians, who chose not to be publicly seen or heard uttering the two most dangerous words in American agriculture, climate change, now want to be seen and heard as climate change leaders? And if so, why did they first have to meet secretly to get their story straight before advocating, after decades of stonewalling and overt denial, that now is the time for taxpayers to pay them to do the right thing? How about doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do? Sorry, not sorry, but the politically powerful groups that sent representatives to the secret conclave, including the American Farm Bureau Federation, U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and Congress, don't get to dictate climate change policy anymore. In fact, they've been doing that for far too long already. Instead, if they want to join the fight, they should join the ongoing fight, publicly, monetarily, and at the ballot box. What they shouldn't do is meet behind closed doors to plan how to seize climate change's high ground so they can drive the policy that most favors them. Besides, the high ground is already mostly gone. Yeah, climate change. John Skipper writes, it's all about perspective and attitude. Silly me. Someone asked me the other day about my perspective on a particular situation. It got me to thinking about that one word, perspective, and what it really means. It would be easy to say it's an attitude or point of view, but it's really much deeper than that. It's a point of view that reflects an attitude. Several years ago, I was in the office of a Cerro Gordo County elected official on election day. He was reading the newspaper and came across an obituary of a woman he knew. Shunning any evidence of grief, he said, nuts, I knew I should have given her an absentee ballot. Get what I mean? A point of view that reflects an attitude. Kids have perspective, they just don't realize it at their young age. Bud Johnson of Mason City likes to tell the story about a conversation he had years ago with his grandson, who was 9 or 10 years old at the time. The grandson said, Grandpa, what's your perspective? What do you mean? Asked Johnson. Well, Grandpa, the youngster replied, it's kind of how you look at things. One of my daughters, when she was a little kid, got into a tussle with a neighborhood kid. I broke up the spat, took her aside, and asked her what started it. He hit me back first, she said. Perspective. In the adult world, we need only look to the current impeachment hearings to see points of view that reflect an attitude from members of both political parties, and it's not pretty. Tommy Lasorda, the old baseball manager, was once asked his perspective on dealing with problems. Don't tell people your troubles, he said. Half the people don't care, and the other half are glad you have them. Perspective. It's been almost 4 years since the city of Mason City dealt with the possibility of Prestige, a North Carolina hog processing corporation, opening a facility in Mason City. It became one of the most divisive issues in the city's history because there were so many legitimate perspectives that were in conflict with one another. The Prestige perspective, finding a location to expand its operation and increase its profits. The city of Mason City perspective, the possibility of bringing in a new industry and creating 2,000 jobs. The EDC and Chamber of Commerce perspective, a proposal that could jumpstart the economy. Opponents' perspective, many citizens were against the prospect of creating health and environmental problems and with the possible influx of immigrants into the community. As many of us remember, the proposal failed by a 3-3 vote of the city council, reflecting in real terms how divided the citizens were. Democracies thrive on perspectives being put on display, acted upon by people of goodwill and without malice, and then moving on. Washington, are you listening? One other example of perspective, this one on a little lighter note. A teenager in North Iowa was preparing to go on a date and was having trouble tying his necktie. His father wasn't home, so he decided to seek the help of a neighbor. The neighbor got behind the young man and tried to tie it as he reached over the teen's shoulders and worked with it. Finally, he told the young man, "You know, this would be a lot easier for me if you were lying down." The neighbor was a funeral director. How's that for perspective? Silly me. Farouk Jessa writes, "The gift of free airport parking." Farouk Jessa is a United States veteran and a resident of Mason City. "When I moved from the congested, unfriendly, cold-hearted big city to friendly, warm-heart, small-town Mason City on October 31st, 2016, one of the most valuable attractions which differentiated Mason City from other small towns was that I have access to Mason City Airport, which offers passengers free parking and regular flights to Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Louis, and Chicago. This is not just an asset to all of us living in Cerro Gordo County and beyond, but a very valuable convenience which no other big city can boast for its residents. On a cold, wintry day, I drove to the airport, parked my car, rolled into the airport, and was on a flight to Chicago O'Hare International Airport, with a connecting flight a few hours later to Tokyo, Japan. I returned back to Mason City a month later, and guess what? My car was in the same place I had left it at, safe and sound, in the airport parking lot. I've done this several times and have been able to travel to Japan, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Republic of Georgia, Armenia, Turkey, Mexico, Egypt, Austria, United Arab Emirates, and the list goes on. The point is, I am thankful and sincerely appreciative of the amenities I have here in Mason City. I can have the comforts and conveniences of small-town Iowa, yet be connected to a big city whenever I want. With the airport not even 10 minutes away from home, I can park my car at no cost at the airport parking lot, hop on a flight with Air Choice One, which offers spacious first-class seating, and be in Chicago in just under 2 hours. The cost was right around $90 one way. Not bad for five-star service. The complimentary parking alone is a savings of anywhere between $10 to $30 a day compared to the big city. Mason City is a great place to live because it enables one to have an excellent quality of life, which every right-minded American seeks to have, at a cost of living that is not West Coast or East Coast crazy, and a level of service and amenities that is truly Midwest cosmopolitan. By birth or by choice, we are Iowans, and we have access to a good quality of life." Today's obituaries include Robert Dunlap, Marilyn Niebergall, Arlene Barber, Wesley Little Mr. Bartz, Winona Winnie Henniger, Verna I. Collier, Luella Pagel, Scott Huntley, Darwin L. Tufte, and Larry Van Dusseldorp. Robert Dunlap, 85, of Rockford, passed away on Tuesday, December 11th at Hospice of North Iowa in Mason City. Robert donated his body to the Des Moines University for research. Memorial services will be held at a later date. Robert Eugene Dunlap was born March 16, 1934, in Iowa City, a son of Donald and Helen McCandless Dunlap. At a young age, his family moved to Ames, where he attended school, graduating in 1953. After graduation, Bob entered the U.S. Air Force, serving as a radar specialist, with his last duty station being at the Waverly Air Force Radar Station. After his military service, Bob moved to Mason City, where he worked at State Brand Creamery and Decker's. He then worked for Curry's many years until his retirement in 1996. Bob was united in marriage with Donna Rickle on August 21, 1973. They have lived in Rockford since then. Bob was a member of Zion Lutheran Church in Rockford and enjoyed working in his flower gardens. Services entrusted to Rhett's Funeral Home, 519 North 1st Street in Green. Marilyn Niebergall was born to Harry and Fern Brown on December 2nd, 1921 at Mason City. She graduated from Mason City High School in 1940. Marilyn was all about family and was her happiest surrounded by them. She liked to hunt for treasures at garage sales, enjoyed her garden, and most of all, babysitting. In 1976, she and her husband, Bill, moved to Arizona. While there, she grandsat for many babies and toddlers. Some were her grandchildren and some were not. She worked in the nursery at Arizona Community School, where she rocked, fed, sang, and cuddled the babies for 3 hours on Sundays and 3 hours on Wednesdays during the women's Bible study. She was in her 70s at that time and retired at 92 years of age. Marilyn died peacefully at her daughter Judy's home on December 2nd. She will be laid to rest in the Veterans Honor section of the Valley of Sun Mortuary and Cemetery on December 11th. Cards may be sent to Judy Hoosman at 7319 West Eugie Avenue, Peoria, Arizona, 85381, and memorials can be sent in her honor to Seasons Hospice at 2020 North Central Avenue, Suite 170, Phoenix, Arizona, 85004-4424. Arlene Barber, 95, of Clear Lake, died Saturday, December 14th at home. Arrangements are pending at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapels. Wesley Little Mr. Dean Bartz, infant son of Dustin Bartz and Jaylee Fulmouth, died Wednesday, December 11th at University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics in Iowa City. A celebration of life will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 17th at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake. Winona Winnie C. Henniger, 92, of Northwood, passed away Friday, December 13th at Good Shepherd Health Center in Mason City, surrounded by her family. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, December 17th at the First United Methodist Church, 1000 First Avenue North in Northwood, with Reverend Bob Lanfear officiating. Military honors will be conducted by members of Our Buddies VFW Memorial Post 6779 of Northwood at the church. Following the service, cremation will be accorded with graveside interment service to be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 18th at the Sunset Rest Cemetery in Northwood. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 16th at Connor Colonial Chapel, 1008 First Avenue South in Northwood. Visitation will continue 1 hour prior to the funeral service at the church. Memorials may be directed to the family to be donated in Winnie's honor. Winona Cecilia Scanandor was born March 16, 1927 in Oneida, Wisconsin, the daughter of James, Jesse, and Miriam Hill Scanandor. As a member of the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin, she was the granddaughter of Cornelius Hill, the last tribal chief and priest of the Oneida Tribe. Winnie grew up in Oneida, Wisconsin for a number of her younger years until the family moved to Milwaukee in her early teens. Following her high school graduation, she went into nursing training in New Jersey. After completing her training, Winnie enlisted in the United States Army as a nurse, completing her basic training in Texas. After basic training, she worked on a base near Osaka, Japan, during part of the Korean War. During her second tour of duty, Winnie was stationed in Heidelberg, Germany. It was during this tour, around 1955, that she met her future husband, Lauren Henniger. The couple was married on April 28, 1956, in Milwaukee, and were blessed with two children. For the next 50 years, Winnie worked in numerous hospitals, nursing homes, and care centers in various states. In April of 2015, Lauren passed away, sharing 59 years of marriage with Winnie. Winnie was a dedicated Packer fan. She enjoyed trips to the casino and playing all types of card games. Years ago, she could be found cruising around town on her pink beach cruiser bicycle. Winnie found happiness in traveling, collecting spoons and photos from everywhere she went. Most of all, Winnie loved her family and spent time with them. Connor Colonial Chapel's Ian Northwood is in charge of arrangements. Verna Irene Collier, 94, formerly of Clarion, died December 2nd in Pacific Palisades, California. Memorial services are at 11 a.m. Thursday, December 19th at United Presbyterian Church in Clarion, with Pastor Bill Kemm officiating. Interment at a later date in Sunny Hill Cemetery in Adair. Visitation will be from 1 hour prior to services at the church. Online condolences at www.ewingfh.com. Luella Pagel, 95, of Grafton, died Saturday, December 14th at Mitchell County Regional Health Center in Osage. Funeral services are 1 p.m. Tuesday, December 17th at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Grafton, with Pastor Solvig A.H. Zamro officiating. Interment is in Grafton Cemetery. Following services, the family will greet friends in the church fellowship hall. Champion Bookhite Funeral Home in Osage is assisting the family. Scott Huntley, 62, of Glendale, Arizona, formerly of Clear Lake, died Saturday, December 14th in Glendale. Arrangements are pending at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake. Darwin Lee Tufte, 91, of Clarion, died Tuesday, December 10th at Clarion Wellness and Rehabilitation Center. Memorial graveside services will be held at Holmes Lutheran Cemetery in the spring of 2020. Online condolences at ewingfh.com. Larry Van Dusseldorp, 72, of Britt, died Thursday, December 12th at home. Funeral services are at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, December 21st at First Lutheran Church, 75th Avenue Northwest in Britt, with Pastor Willie Rosen officiating. Burial in Evergreen Cemetery in Britt. Visitation is 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Friday, December 20th at Ewing Funeral Home in Britt, and continue 1 hour prior to services at the church. Keep Them Coming, Cheer Fund Donations, by Globe Gazette staff. North Iowa families are already preparing to have a better Christmas thanks to your generosity, but we still have a ways to go. Last year at this time, we were over $60,000. Let's make Christmas wonderful for as many possible in North Iowa. Please give if you can. Today's total, $9,625. To date, total, $48,849. To reach goal, $79,151. Steve and Mary Went, in loving memory of our parents, Glennis and Doris Steiger, and Elmer and Marge Wendt, and Sister Catherine Steiger Meyer, $50. Thomas and Patricia Schultz, $50. Joan Bartell, $50. Janice Dorenkamp, in memory of my husband Richard, $50. Janice Dorenkamp, in memory of our parents, Anne and Ole Burma, and Jake and Elsie Dorenkamp, $25. Larry and Donna Gray, in loving memory of Harold Ruth and Dennis Gray, and Tom and Myrtle Helling, $100. Anonymous, $25. Byron and Gwen Sunken, $50. Janet Dockstatter, in memory of Daryl and William John Dockstatter, $50. Kenneth and Betty Huntley, for loved ones, $50. Marty and Nancy Jelly, Merry Christmas to all, $35. Their family, in memory of our loving parents, Helen and Lester Meske, $50. Melvin and Ann Sletten, in memory of loved ones, $20. Bob, in memory of Marlene Frine, and in honor of the Joe and Julie Frine family, $50. Terry and Mickey Tyrell, $25. Jean and James Marinos, $25. Kim and Sue Plegenkuhl, in memory of our parents, our son Cade, and our sister Joan, have a blessed Christmas, $200. James and Christine Wallace, $25. Ken and Cindy Shizik, in memory of Arthur Shizik, $50. Ken and Cindy Shizik, in memory of Richard Dole, $50. Barbara Wood Konigsfeld, in memory of loved ones, $25. Jack and Verna Alverson, in memory of loved ones, $25. Bob and Kathy Lee Halford, in memory of Robbie Halford, $50. Lloyd and Carol Tinkey, $50. Joe and Chris Plank, $250. Shirley Grand Gennett, in memory of Harold, $15. Willie and Marcine Moore, in memory of loved ones, $100. Margaret McLaughlin, $100. Capola Inn Bed and Breakfast, $100. In memory of John W. Freeze, $100. Ann Larenson, in memory of family and friends, $50. Odella Vosburgh, in memory of loved ones, $25. Ralph and Virginia Dirks, $100. Richard and Marcia Formanek, in memory of Jim, Agnes, and Eileen Formanek, $50. James and Janice Holahan, $20. Michael and Donna Johnson, $50. Wayne and Becky Kudedge, $30. Margaret Fox, $25. Mary Crawford, $15. CIS, Merry Christmas, $20. LaVon Blackmire, in loving memory of Dean Blackmire, $25. Anonymous, $20. Ruby Austin, $20. Madonna and Dennis Isley, $25. Carol Schultz, $30. Kathleen Muff, in memory of Ron, $100. Blake and Nancy Barnes, $100. Unitarian Fellowship of North Central Iowa, $250. Leon Anderson, $25. Frank and Marguerite Bricka, $50. Jerry and Barb Knoll, in loving memory of our daughter Sarah, $150. Anonymous, $200. Kathleen Muth, in honor of my father and my mother, Herb Kuhlmeier and Esther Bauman, $50. Larry and Karen Schroeder, $25. Dan and Karen Peterson, memory of our loved ones, missed at Christmas and always, $25. Richard Nail, in loving memory of loved ones, $50. Wayne and Rita Blaisdell, $50. The Snyders, Merry Christmas, $25. Martha Norum, $30. Evelyn Sell and Artie Hahn, $200. Brian Nettleson, in memory of Gerald Nettleton, Jim O'Brien and Jim Fesenmeyer, $100. Carolyn and William Hornung, $25. James and Patricia Euchre, Merry Christmas, everyone, $30. Bill and Gwen Gasperi, in honor of our friends and family, past and present, $150. Alan and Lucille Sampson, $30. Lowell and Ella Mae Butler, in memory of our parents, $100. In memory of Flash Gordon, $20. Dave and Polly Sunken, in memory of loved ones, $50. In memory of loved ones, Merry Christmas, $10. Dwayne and Robin Tabbert, Merry Christmas, $50. Jamie and Nancy Zanios, Atlas Mini Warehouses, in memory of Tom and Tula Zanios, Bill and June Smythe, and Tom Zanios Jr., $100. Mark Michaels, $50. Bonnie Dubel, $25. Dan Kroll, in memory of a family, $100. Laura and William Jenkinson, $100. Jean and Kathy Henricks, $100. Arlene Eng, given in memory of my husband Willis and son Arnold Eng, $50. Blessed Anonymous, Merry Christmas and a Blessed New Year, $50. Thomas and Jacqueline Martin, $25. Rich Halverson, in memory of Andy, $200. Roger and Deborah Tack, in memory of Christy Hurstness, $20. Anonymous, $50. Alice Gradius, in memory of Art Gradius, $100. Lulu Brown, in memory of my daughter Ellen Ann, $25. Dean and Karen Junkins, $100. Diane Callahan Salling and John Callahan family, in memory of John Callahan, $100. Jeffrey Rowe, $1,000. Jean and Doreen Jakubek, in memory of Jakubek and Preschul families, $25. Leland Hummel and Diane Statlander, in memory of Jolene Chiodo and Beulah Hummel, Merry Christmas, $100. Russell and Mary Immel, for the memory of our mother Ruth Borcherding, who passed away this year, $75. Mark and Monica Hurd, $25. Eugene Brandt, $25. Craig and Linda Ackerman, $100. Brad and Pat Fairbanks, $50. Richard and Donna Blanchard, $100. Tom and Marilyn Hanna, $100. David and Sherry Platts, in loving memory of Evelyn Bergman, $100. Daughters of Union Veterans of Civil War Tent 42, $20. Larry and Karen Espinosa, in loving memory of James and Bertha Duggan, Ann Lawrence and Gladys Espinosa, $20. Harlan and Marge Bach, In memory of loved ones and in honor of our family and friends, 25. DeVries and Price, 100. Clear Lake Lioness Club, 50. Patricia Bublitz, in memory of Robert, Darlene, and Curtis Bublitz, 30. Stuart and Julie Oltrage, in memory of Wally Johnson and Wayne Oltrage, 100. Joseph and Mary Jill Thorson, 300. Jeff, Roxanne, Tyler, and Kayla Newell, in memory of Ben Newell, 100. Yvonne and Tom Stibble, 25. Richard and Nadine Wagner, in memory of Wagner and Trope families, 100. David and Lori Ricken, in loving memory of William Kasich Jr., 250. In memory of James Nelson, Ann and Oli Burma, and Rose and Clarice Nelson, 100. Frank Vogt and family, in memory of Marjorie Vogt, 20. Anonymous, 100. Judy Nielsen and family, in memory of our loved ones, 500. Steve and Vicki Rye, in loving memory of our parents, Tom and Claudia Rye, Ann Ray and Ruth Pedersen, 50. Donna Pedalty, in loving memory to my parents, my daughter, Kim Bernard, my brother, Bob Christensen, and sister-in-law, Pam Christensen, miss you, $50. Gordy Weinman, in memory of Heidi Weinman and Judy Weinman, 25. Brian, Amanda, Haley, Sammy, Zach, Braylon, Anna, and Riley, in memory of Grandpa Nort and Tara, 50. Mark, Lori, Bill, Jeff, Laura, and wife Marilyn, in memory of Dad, 50. H. Marilaine Fuhrer Muth, in memory of A. Milton Ferrier and Melvin F. Muth, 40. Florence Beek, in memory of my husband Gary Beek and daughter-in-law Jessica Beek, 100. Leanne and Ward Elwood, in memory of our loved ones, 50. North Iowa Amateur Radio Club, 25. Mardine Lean, in memory of Spencer Annenson, 50. Larry and Donna Klein, in memory of Shirley Bellew and Jim Johnson, 25. Don and Florence Johnson, in memory of our son Wayne, our parents JJ and Flora Drury, and Wendell and Ann Johnson. To all our families, Merry Christmas, 50. Verna Drail, in memory of my guardian angel, 50. Since the Cheer Fund began in 1927, more than $3 million has been raised to help about 2,700 North Iowa families. This year's goal is $125,000. The Christmas Cheer Fund was established by Globe Gazette publisher Lee Loomis in 1927, so every child could have a present on Christmas morning. In the years since, it has come to mean a little help at Christmas time to people of all ages. Donations may be dropped off or mailed to the Globe Gazette office, 300 North Washington Avenue, Mason City, 50402-0271. We guarantee that your gift, no matter the size, will help someone in North Iowa have a better, brighter Christmas, just like every Christmas since the Cheer Fund's founding in 1927. In celebrations, John Holler, Marine veteran, will turn 90 on Saturday, December 21st, a perfect occasion to celebrate this momentous milestone. Birthday greetings may be sent to The Meadows, 1600 10th Street Southeast, Unit D1, Mason City, 50401. Wishing you joy and health, John. Cheers to 90 years. And Larry Dixon and Sharon Birdzill Dixon of Mason City were married December 4th, 1959. At the Little Brown Church in Nashua. They celebrated their 60th wedding anniversary with a family dinner and request no gifts, please. Lowe named NIAC's Papa John Center Entrepreneur of the Month. Brittany Lowe of Fringe and Lace by Brittany was named as the NIAC John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center and the North Iowa Area SBDC November Entrepreneur of the Month. According to a release from NIAC, Fringe and Lace by Brittany is bringing boutique retail back to Northwood. Lowe has always loved to sew. In high school, she used her talent while working in a bridal shop, making alterations. When she married Tom Lowe, a lifelong resident of Northwood, she began a side business doing alterations for friends and family out of her home. As her friends and family increasingly referred their friends, Brittany realized that she could take this side business to full time. I was so busy just from word of mouth and personal recommendations, Lowe said in the release. Digital marketing has worked well for our demographic, but referrals and word of mouth are still the best kind of marketing a business can have. As Lowe considered taking her alterations full-time, she also noticed something going on in her community. Every spring, local girls were preparing for prom by reselling and buying their formal dresses on social media. After hearing about girls meeting up at gas stations and trying on dresses in bathrooms, Lowe saw that these girls needed a safe and clean location to sell their previously loved dresses. In early 2017, she founded Fringe Lace by Brittany, an alterations and consignment dress shop specializing in prom dresses and tuxedos. After a year, Lowe worked with the Nyack Papa John Center in North Iowa area SBDC to find the best way for her business to grow. They helped me put all the pieces together, she said. Before I made any moves, we made sure it was a good decision to add the bridal line, add the bridesmaid dresses, and expand into a bigger location. In February 2018, Fringe and Lace by Brittany opened at its new location on Central Avenue in downtown Northwood. Lowe said it was important to found her business in Northwood. Brick-and-mortar clothing retail is increasingly concentrated in larger metro areas as online sales continue to drive change in industry. She looked at her business as an opportunity to bring some retail back to town and keep it there. My mindset is that I don't have to be the biggest, but I want to be the best. Everything we do is focused to provide that small town service, the top trends, the best variety, and the best quality at a price point that's realistic for our area. Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg presented Lowe with the Entrepreneur of the Month Award at Fringe and Lace by Brittany in Northwood on November 19th. Learn more about Fringe and Lace by Brittany by visiting online at www.fringeandlacebybrittany, which is spelled BRITTANY.com. Today we have a column by J.W. Sales entitled, Real Life Family Stories Often Equal Those That Are Legend. There are family myths and legends that survive beyond generations. Most are hearsay at best. Many are downright enormous fabrications that in original form were intended to separate our families from the humdrum melting pot realities of just making it to America. You know the tales I'm talking about. Great Uncle Max rode with Jesse James. Grandpa's third cousin twice removed survived Custer's last stand. Grandma's sister invented nylon. Great Grandma's fourth cousin Matilda was a burlesque stripper coming to America who survived the sinking of the Titanic and who claimed the identity of John Jacob Astor's niece and lived happily ever after. If we really could have sold the world on any of those legends, we would have been rock stars in our own time. Yet, as every day I progress at a faster pace toward the eternal grass nap, I realize that our true accumulated family stories are just as fun to hear as any that were grossly fabricated. As I increasingly find myself in the position of custodian of elder dead relatives' possessions and their lifetime of accumulated papers, I understand that the hidden family treasures buried in the least likely places are the fragile remnants validating who we are as a family and whom we are proud to be. I recently discovered this gift from my grandpa in the depths of shredding a couple tons of my late uncle's treasure of paper hoardings. My grandfather's family were prolific progenitors. At a time when you had a maximum number of children just to offset the 50% that would not survive to adulthood, he had 17 surviving brothers and sisters. That equates to a potential myriad family tales waiting to be told. Some of those are predictable skeletons in the closet that should and will remain unclaimed secrets. But those that are fun, funny, and inspiring are many. As with many large families at that time, younger male siblings and all female siblings were excluded from any inheritance and legacy to take their families forward. If you had a second marriage after the patriarchal widowing, then the complications become insurmountable. So during the Christmas season of 1922, my great-grandfather, who was the seventh of eight children and thereby missing the cut for an inheritance, rounded up his family and claimed a farm in Worth County near the town of Middleton, Carpenter. That family migration was an orchestrated miracle. According to the written remembrances of my grandfather, the multi-pronged pilgrimage, was indeed a mastermind of logistics. My great-grandfather made plans to not only move all of the kids and family in one fell swoop, he also leased a cattle car for livestock and bought passenger train tickets on the Rock Island for the least hardy of the tribe, all in the depths of a harsh Iowa winter. As that did not sound impossible, nor superhuman, I continued to read my grandpa's words, and what came next with the rest of the story stopped me in my tracks. As with any farm family, everyone had their assigned chores, and the family move was no different. Yet there were some of the family tucked in a warm railroad passenger car, great-grandma, her teenage daughter, and all the youngest kids, including the baby who was still nursing. But one troop, led by the eldest brother and containing my grandfather, with another brother and two sisters, traveled in the family 1919 Model T automobile, and with no side curtains, snaked their way north on what is Highway 65. The road was unpaved, without gravel, and full of chuck holes. My grandpa claims his brother, the driver, hit every single one from Marshalltown to Northwood. That accounts for everyone except my great-grandfather and his eldest daughter. Believe it or not, they rode all the way in the cattle car with the livestock, keeping water for the animals thawed with a kerosene blowtorch. On Christmas Day of 1922, all three groups of my father's merry band of gypsies converged at their new farm. Everyone was uncomfortable in some way, but was no worse for wear. The reunion was a cause of great thanks and joy, as a new neighbor had cut and decorated a Christmas tree and left it on the porch. There concluded their trip to the end of the world. There are those that say our younger generations are not good custodians of family history and lore. I disagree. I believe that if us old folks retell these stories of family resilience and overcoming great obstacles, they will realize that in their life, surrender is not an option. Share your family stories this Christmas season, this holiday season, and Merry Christmas. Autumn in Iowa was cooler, wetter than usual this year. Special to the Globe Gazette. A team of state and federal experts who compile a monthly water summary for Iowa say autumn this year has been cooler and wetter than normal. Temperatures for September, October, and November averaged 49.3 degrees, less than a degree below normal, while precipitation totaled 12.33 inches, or 4.3 inches above normal. Despite November being drier than normal, the last 18 months in Iowa have been the wettest on record. Soil moisture and shallow groundwater look good going into the winter months, said Tim Hall, coordinator of hydrology resources for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Stream flows continue to be above normal for most of the state, while drought conditions are non-existent, Hall said. Nationally, there is little drought across the country, with the exception being of the Four Corners area of the Southwest, east into Kansas, and parts of Texas. For a thorough review of Iowa's water resource trends, go to iowadnr.gov/water summary update. That's all one word. Along with DNR officials, the report is prepared by technical staff from the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, IIHR, Hydroscience and Engineering, and the U.S. Geological Survey, in collaboration with Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management Department. This brings us to the end of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, December 15th, 2019. Your reader today has been John Manning. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of IRIS or KCMR. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for today's reading in the Des Moines Register. You are listening to IRIS, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day.